Hi, and this is the Physics High Podcast. A quick quiz. Do you A, want to be inspired by science communicators? B, want to learn all about science education? C, want guidance on your scientific journey? Well, how about D, all of the above? Now, my guest today is the internationally respected physicist and educational researcher, Dr. Carl Wieman. Now, his career has taken from theoretical research to improving the quality of physics education around the world. Now, his career started in optical and laser physics, and this led him to becoming the first person to verify the existence of the fifth state of matter, or the Bose-Einstein condensate. And as a result, in 2001, he received the Nobel Prize for Physics for his work. He then moved to physics education research. He's been responsible for improving the quality of physics education in universities and pioneered the use of experimental techniques to evaluate the effectiveness of various teaching strategies for physics and also other sciences. And not surprisingly, he's received numerous prestigious awards for his work. And in 2002, he used his money from the Nobel Prize to found the FET Interactive Simulations Project, which has since developed over 160 research-based physics and mathematics simulations, been translated in over 95 countries, and has been used over 800 million times. And on top of this, he served as chair of the Board on Science Education for the National Academy of Sciences, and also served as Associate Director for the Science in the White House Office of Science and Technology. It's an honor and gives me great pleasure to welcome Dr. Carl Wieman. Welcome.
Nice to be here.
You've had a very long, distinguished career, and everything from theoretical physics to obviously physical education research. Let's start with your theoretical physics, and really, I guess the area that really set you on the map that particularly became internationally renowned was your Nobel Prize. No doubt a key highlight for you was the Nobel Prize with Eric Cornell and Wolfgang Kettler about the discovery of or the existence of the Bose-Einstein condensate. Can you tell us a little bit about what a Bose-Einstein condensate is and how did you go about actually detecting it?
So I will, but first I'll tell you that, to be honest, the highlight was first being able to see the Bose-Einstein condensate for the first time, which was a couple of years before the Nobel Prize. And it was notable really for the fact, not just it was an important thing we've been working on, but unlike almost every other research project that I and most others have been involved with, when it happened, it was something where it showed up much, you know, sort of beautifully, perfectly, almost from the beginning. Now, you know, this was after 6 or 7 years of hard work, but we turned on the apparatus. And, you know, usually when you have a discovery like this, you see some tiny little signal and you keep turning the knobs and you, over the next few months, try and make it a little bigger and a little better. And finally, it's convincing enough you can show it to the world and get it accepted. And this was exceptional because it was about the third generation of experiment trying to make this, but we turned it on and it appeared just spectacularly beautifully. I mean, you know, the image that we had sort of been telling people, well, ideally this is what it's going to look like. And it looked just like that. So there was no kind of argument or question that it was really there. So anyway, how do we do it and what do we see? Well, first, what it is it's a really a new form of matter. Back in about, I think it was 1904 or something, Einstein predicted using some ideas of Bose and applying them in a different way, predicted that if you got atoms cold enough, they would turn into this new form of matter where instead of being all separate little objects, they would fuse together into, we call it a sort of a super quantum wave. So it's a completely quantum mechanical thing. You know, the laws of quantum mechanics are something you usually see or only see indirectly because they're deep, tiny inside atoms and so on. This is really a manifestation of, you know, the size of a human hair. So a thing you can actually, we look at it with a microscope, but it's not that hard to see. And so it was something he predicted would happen, but it you look at what temperature it is, and it's sort of, you know, millions of a degree above absolute zero. So he and most other people didn't really take it very seriously. And it was only sort of decades later that people started thinking, well, maybe you could really make this, and started working on it. But it required getting atoms much, much colder than they'd ever been able to get before. And so that's, you not only have to get them cold, but you have to hold them there because you can't, they can't touch anything because the rest of the universe is much, much hotter. So the trick was to hold them and cool them. And so we, over some years and using ideas that other people had come up with and I'd been working on, but it was first to use laser light to cool them down so we could take this sample of atoms. It was just a kind of rubidium atoms, but that was just a nothing special about it except it's good for cooling with laser light. And so we use these techniques of shining laser light on in a special way. It cools them down from room temperature down to, oh, 10 millionths or so of a degree above absolute zero, which is, you know, pretty good, but not nearly good enough to get Bose-Einstein condensation. Then we put them into a little magnetic bowl, so have magnetic fields, which if you have atoms that are that cold, you shape right-shaped magnetic field will hold them there, suspended in space in a vacuum, so nothing touches them. And then we do something called evaporative cooling, which is a second stage of cooling, which is really the same physics that happens in a coffee, is why your coffee or tea cools off, that steam coming off. That's the most energetic coffee molecules leaping out of the cup. And as they're doing that, they're taking away more than their share of the energy. So the ones that are left behind get cold. And so that's what we would do, is laser cool them, put them in our magnetic cup, if you like, carefully let the most energetic ones leap out and get it colder and colder and colder until finally it would take a couple minutes. Suddenly it would fuse into this condensation, it's called the condensation because they are kind of all fused together into this giant quantum wave, and we could see it suddenly appear by looking at it as suddenly getting much smaller and denser, floating there in space.
Now, we're not talking about ordinary lasers here. Now, I know you got two patents out for laser diodes. Are those the lasers that you had to develop to produce this situation?
Yeah, so this all actually started. I mean, if you look at how I ended up doing that, I was working on, I mean, I'd done other bunch of atomic physics experiments with atoms and lasers, really for many years doing measurements of different kinds. But in the process of those, to do the experiments, we needed lasers that would have certain characteristics. And in particular, we took the same kind of lasers that are in compact disc players. And we figured out how to use those to probe atoms and in this case, laser cool them. We had to do some tricks so that to keep the color of light that comes out of them had to be very precise and very well controlled. So it just matches the color of light that atoms like to absorb. But in doing that, we also came up with lasers with these characteristics that were, you know, they cost about $100 as opposed to people who were doing similar sorts of experiments, but cost about $250,000. Wow. So we developed those, and then we were just kind of looking around for fun things to do. And so we started copying what other people had been doing. Steve Chu and Bill Phillips, who got the Nobel Prize for their work in using laser light to cool atoms. And we just showed we could do it much, much cheaper and simpler with these kinds of lasers. But because it works so well, we started and with the laser cooling, and we could get atoms so cold, and it was so cheap to try experiments with, we were able to start then pursuing Bose-Einstein condensation. I mean, first we just probed getting atoms, seeing how cold we could get them, seeing how they behaved when they were really cold, because people hadn't been able to study atoms and how they interacted at those temperatures before. So we did a series of, you know, sort of bread and butter experiments, understanding atoms at this temperature under these conditions. And that was really the whole, it was only after several years of doing that, we got started thinking, hey, I understand how these behave well enough and really better than anybody else. I can see there's a, this could be a route to get to this Bose-Einstein condensation, which was sort of a holy grail for atomic physics for a long time. People wanted to get there, but kept struggling unsuccessfully to make it. So, but it really started with just kind of developing some new technology and then looking at fun things to do with it. I mean, I'll just say, since you have, you know, future physicists and scientists in the audience, I think one of the really ways much of my physics career has gone was really looking for places where there's new technologies coming along, where you can look to be able to probe and manipulate matter and materials in new ways. And that opens up exciting new areas of science. And I, you know, the Bose-Einstein condensate is kind of the one that's got the most attention, but there've been several other kind of important physics things along the way of just seeing what capabilities new technology gives you to do science. It's a good way of discovering interesting fields.
In 2004, you won the Professor of the Year Award postgraduate work. And in your acceptance speech, you say you have not a passion for teaching, but more a passion for learning. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
I have a passion for having other people learning. Okay. So, I mean, you know, at some level, I think knowing science and knowing how to think in the process of scientific thinking is really an enormous advancement, if you like, enormous capability of the human brain. And so, you know, for me, having people learn that and develop those capabilities seems like a really valuable thing to do. And so I at some point start realizing you could treat that like a science. You can do experiments on different ways of teaching. You can measure carefully what people are and are not learning. You can, you know, get data. You can develop theories to guide what you're doing. You can test those theories. And so probably about 10 years before I got the Nobel Prize, I started actually doing that kind of scientific research. And so for about 20 years, I actually had two research groups. One would blast atoms with lasers. The others would torture students teach students with you know, new and better ways, actually make them not just happier, but learn better physics and then science in general. So for the past 15 or so years, I've really focused entirely on the teaching and learning and research of that. And, you know, it's a very different kind of subject, but it has many of the same intellectual challenges to me. You know, you're trying to think of how to design experiments that reveal new things, new insights, and apply those, how to get the right kind of data, how to analyze complicated data with lots of factors involved. So, you know, and you could make real discoveries, and these discoveries are pretty more immediately applicable than something like BEC.
I'm a big fan of particularly of peer instruction. And I know you are too, and you've obviously done the research on that. Apart from, well, maybe including peer instruction, what do you think has been one of the most significant things you've discovered that educators, whether it's undergraduate universities or teachers in the high school, should consider when they're teaching physics?
So, you know, I'd say it's probably biased by the fact it's recent and I'm excited about it. But I think probably the most important thing is something I've done really quite recently. And that was we interviewed a whole bunch of expert, you know, not super high level, but, you know, very successful, acknowledged, prominent scientists and engineers across all the different fields of science and actually into medicine and engineering. And we've interviewed them as they went through solving some real problem they've done in their work. And what we've discovered is, you know, what you might think of these, you know, a biologist or a physicist or a chemical engineer, you might think that they look quite different in how they solve problems. We discovered they actually have the same set of decisions, and it's not an enormous set. There's 29 decisions that they make in solving problems, and they all make the same set of decisions. And so, you know, these are things like, you know, when they first look at the problem, what information do you, you know, are they going to need to solve this problem? What simplifications or approximations can they make? Then, you know, what are the most, you know, priorities of finding out what's the most least certain parts, and it goes through to then they collect data and they have to decide how to analyze that data, how reliable that data is. And so anyway, there's these 29, many of them, like I just listed, are obvious. Some of them aren't quite so obvious, but we find that they're all making them. One that's not so obvious is, you know, these are new field, new areas. And so they get new information. They all have to decide how they actually are going to represent the information, you know, whether it's a graph or a figure, that those representations are really guided by helping them understand how to use that information to solve the problem. And so they put a lot of thought. Anyway, so why is this important? Well, it's important because ultimately the whole value of any of these fields is people being able to use them to solve problems. And what we find is now solving problems is about making this set of decisions. So if you want to now go back and say, how's the best way to teach people to solve problems? This is much better. We know how to do that now, much better than before, because before people say, well, you know, the classic teaching approach is, here's a bunch of information you're going to need. So learn all this information and now go off and solve this problem. And the person, either student, can either solve that problem and say, okay, good, or can't solve the problem. You tell them, well, try solving this one, you know, keep working at it. And it's sort of a trial and error sort of thing. Now we can get much more targeted. We can say, you need to learn to make this decision. So now practice making this specific decision, and I'll give you feedback on how you do. You master that, then you can master these other decisions. And so it's really much more like, if you're thinking about, let's say, learning to play golf, the classic way, if you take the usual way women teach, that we teach physics, it's equivalent to say, you know, try and hit this ball in the hole. Oh, you didn't succeed. Try it again until you succeed. Now we've figured out, okay, we can teach them, here's how to hold the golf club. You know, here's how to take it back. Here's what to watch, you know, of the ball when you're going to hit it. And so breaking it down, helping people practice and master these things. And also at the end, we find we can now make tests, which are much, much more accurate measures of how well people can actually solve problems. And therefore, you know, if your teaching approach is working, you know, if the student's ready to move on or not than before. So anyway, like I say, it's very new. It's not widely known, but I think it's actually going to be more important than any of the other work that I've done.
Are there any papers, published papers on this?
We're still working on getting it published. That's a whole other story. It's so different than the way people have thought about really expertise and problem solving that it takes a little while to get through the public review and publication process.
I'll be looking for it. I'm sure others, educators, hopefully listening as well, because it sounds actually really, really valuable. In 2002, you started FET. Now, and I'm aware you used your Nobel Prize money to actually start that. Can you tell us a little bit more what led to you wanting to do that? I mean, I know that many educators and students watching this probably are very familiar with FET as their teachers using it in the classroom. What was the inspiration to you starting that?
The inspiration was really, you know, came from my work in science, physics education, but realizing that physicists, and actually all scientists, but I'll talk about physicists in particular, they have these mental models. They have in their brain a model of how a system works, you know, whether it's, you know, cars running into objects or moving and so on, that sort of is a simplified model and of the fact important features and how they're related and how they behave. And what I came to realize through working with some other people who are doing computer education things is that the computer and the interactive simulations in particular gave us the option of really creating the and making much more explicit these expert physicists or just plain physicists' mental models of the phenomena, and did it in such a way that they could see what a physicist would visualize in terms of things like electrons moving and photons moving and what was happening to the atoms when you had friction. And they also, it made it possible for people to visualize and see these things much more clear as students to do this. But then you could also change parameters and see in real time how that would change things. And so you could do the equivalent of changing the color of laser light that shines on an atom, or you could, what's even more radical because you can't do it in the real world, is you could change the spacing of the electron levels in an atom, and you could see how that would change their behavior, you know, and that's all part of the model that a physicist has, but it takes you know, many years to sort of develop that, because you and this just, I can't realize this is a technology that just allowed that much more effective way to teach. And it made it a lot more fun because you didn't just have to sit and think. You could change things, or as a student, you change things at kind of a little more video game like, but really in the process of that, you know, you can ask yourself questions about, okay, if you had a laser, and I mean, we have a simulation of a laser, and yes, well, if I change the reflection, you know, I got mirrors on it, I change the reflection on that mirror, what actually happens to the light coming out, for example, you know, and in principle, you could build an experiment and, you know, after $20,000 in 2 years, you could find out yourself, but we allow you to do it in 5 minutes.
Yeah, it's a fantastic tool. And certainly its success is shown by the fact that you've got over, 860 million was on the website at the moment of people accessing it. It's incredible. It's 95 languages.
It's 65. I think the latest numbers are, it's getting almost 2 million uses a day. It turns out the COVID has made a big boost in its use. In a lot of countries, it's been a doubling of the use. And so it turns out with everybody stuck at home, having to learn at home, it's, you know, which gratifying to me because, you know, people need all the help they can get these days. And this is providing some.
Yeah, and they're able to do experiments at home as a result. I mean, the teachers can actually provide, say, look, follow these instructions or what we know, and then give me feedback of what you've learned in the process. Yeah, it's been very valuable. Yeah. Do you have a favorite FET animation?
Not really. I use the circuit construction kit is a really useful one that shows the capabilities of the simulation. It's easy for people to understand. In teaching, it turns out, I teach introductory quantum mechanics. The FET simulations for introductory quantum mechanics are really powerful. They're tremendously effective, much, much better than any other way to learn that stuff. So I'm sort of torn between those two areas, I would say.
And I must say, the move toward HTML5 has made a big difference, hasn't it, in terms of moving away from Flash, which obviously is now defunct. But the accessibility now has increased again as a result of the many devices that students now have access to.
One detail is, gosh, that's expensive, as it turns out. It's really cost, and it's hard to get the money to just convert it, but it's a challenge. But as you say, we just have to do it, but it has been a real difficulty.
Is that because of the in terms of the software engineers required to do that?
Yeah, it's a big software job.
Turning my attention back to you grew up in Oregon, and I guess one writer was saying a quite unconventional upbringing. How did you get into science in terms of what took you to where you are now?
Oh, you know, not a very direct route. I grew up, spent much up to grade 7, really lived way deep in the forest where, you know, the nearest paved or sealed, as you would say, road was miles away. And that's a long story about how my parents ended up there, but, you know, my father cut down trees. So anyway, and I don't really know originally how I got interested. I was always interested in kind of building things and designing things. That was part of living way out in the woods. You didn't go buy things because the nearest store was a long ways away. And so you had to figure out how to do things. And I just liked doing that. And, you know, that wasn't really doing science, but it had a lot of scientific elements to it. And certainly the science that I did do, the part I liked best and was probably the excelled at was figuring out how to build new apparatus to do new things with. So that I can sort of trace back to my, you know, very young age. But in school, I was in, you know, primary, particularly secondary school, I was interested in science of pretty much all types, but I was also interested in other things like writing. And so when I went off to university, I remember saying, well, kind of like physics, but I also want to do writing, and hadn't really decided. So I got to university, and actually I did terribly on my first physics test and first physics course, just barely passed it. But I, through kind of a quirk, got involved in working in a research lab as a first year student. That was pretty unusual in those days. And that for me was a very different experience from taking courses, and much more rewarding. I felt I was, you know, much more successful. It seemed much more interesting because courses, it was kind of like trying to figure out the tricks of the instructor, whereas in the research lab, you were trying to figure out the way the universe worked. And that was just a whole lot more worthwhile. And it involved a lot more kind of independent decision-making and figuring things out on your own, not just trying to remember what somebody else wanted you to remember. So, And so from then on, I spent really almost all my university career was avoiding taking courses as much as possible, spending as much time in the research lab as I could. But it was really the research lab experience that got me into science and got me excited about it and really also provided me with almost all my real education.
Which is fascinating, really, because when people think of science, at least the general population, they think, oh, you have to learn this and learn that and learn that. And what you are touching on really is where true science happens is where you try to answer the questions that are curiosity driven. In many ways, your story only cements the whole idea of that if you want to do science, it's about asking questions and trying to answer them, not learning a whole amount of facts and so forth.
That's right. And I think, you know, and I don't use myself as a particularly useful data point, but it is true that, you know, if you look at, okay, what did I learn in the research lab? I, in fact, avoided class as much as possible. So I skipped over a whole bunch of topics that any physics professor will tell you, oh, no, you got to learn all those things. But what I did learn was how to think about figuring things out, how to realize when I needed to know something, how to go about knowing it, how to go about learning it. And so, yeah, I didn't cover much of this formal stuff at all, but I did know how to go learn the formal stuff when it was useful. And so I think that modern research on learning, it says, yeah, it's not that important what particular knowledge people memorize, but what is important is how they think about making decisions and how they can go and find the information they need to make those decisions. And so a lot of the things we're now having students do in the class is doing that. And yeah, we bring in some physics knowledge because it's important to understand how to apply it, but it's really using that knowledge and practicing using that knowledge is what we're trying to have the students do as much as possible.
I want to move to science communication in general. Now, in that speech that I mentioned, you made an interesting quote, and I want to ask you to maybe elaborate on this. And I quote you here. I said, "I firmly believe that when anyone gets a better understanding of the world around them and how it is governed by the certain scientific principles that make its behavior comprehensible and predictable rather than mysterious and frightening, it will improve their lives and allow them to better and more successful citizens." Can you tell us a little bit more about what your thoughts are there?
Well, it goes back to, since that speech, as my thinking has evolved a little bit, but really to appreciate the real value of education is it allows people to make better decisions. And, you know, that means better decisions in their job, better decisions about their own life personally, better decisions about you know, public policy. And science these days is really important in all of those areas. In terms of the environment and dealing with the future of the environment, that's fundamentally technical. And you just can't be, a good citizen able to make wise decisions as part of a democracy without understanding the basic science and science processes that go into global warming, for example, pollution and energy sources, the trade-offs and so on. And this, as we've seen in the last year, it's also, some people think, well, I shouldn't wear masks or I should wear masks and whether vaccines and so on. Those are all things that involve that's a case where the decisions an individual makes have a profound effect on them personally and on their family and on their, the people around them. And those decisions, you can make those decisions just much better if you have a basic grasp of science as opposed to thinking, well, whatever somebody says on the internet must be true and I should follow that advice.
You sort of touch on to my next question, and I'm certain your thoughts have changed since 2004, because since 2004, we have the explosion of information on the internet, even more so than in the previous 10, 15 years to that. And then, of course, social media particularly has been a big impact. How have you seen those things affect the scientific literacy that is evident in society? And what impact does that have for science communicators like yourselves and others?
You know, I can't really answer that question. I mean, it's not like people had enormous embrace and literacy in science before. It has made a lot of the crazy ideas more obvious and sort of shared them more broadly, but it's not like things weren't before. So, you know, I don't really know, is this worse or are we just noticing it more now than we did before, to be honest. But I think it does make it clear, and in particular, the impacts of bad decisions, non-scientific decisions, the impact of those has become much more prominent in the last several years, 10 years and last year. And so I think that does make it that much more important that scientists, science communicators kind of have a more important job and a very important responsibility. And in this, from my research on teaching and learning, I'll say one thing where I think the science communication, particularly as practiced by scientists, has a big flaw to it, and that they tend to, you know, scientists will come out and they arguments on whatever they're trying to communicate, they'll tell people all this great facts and things they know, and they'll justify it by saying, well, you know, all my friends, all my other scientists, you know, believe this too. And that's really not convincing, going to be convincing to people, because it's making claims and it's justifying those claims just according to some arbitrary authority. And, you know, so why should I believe, if I'm some person in the street, why should I believe that this person any better than I believe this person who claims they're an authority on it? And so the real way that you have to convince people is to teach them about the process. Don't give them a lot of facts. Have them understand the process by which we come to believe these facts to be true. You know, really the thinking, the scientific thinking, the scientific process, that's much more convincing to people than what than just saying, oh, we know this, you should believe me because I'm smart.
What advice would you give to a student who's thinking of adding a science course within the course of their studies?
You know, my advice would be to look for the right teacher. I mean, I think at that level, it's all about the attitudes of the teacher in terms of, you know, the right teacher will find the right material and the right way to present it to be meaningful to you, and the wrong one will be bad no matter what else is in place.
My last question here, Dr. Wyman, is this. If you had an opportunity to share what you're really passionate about that is not necessarily science related, what would that be?
You know, I'm always the most excited about my work. I can't help it. So I've told you, you know, our new research on teaching and learning, of this problem, teaching problem solving. And, you know, for better or worse, I think that's probably always been a characteristic of me, is that what I'm really excited about is what I'm working on. And that's, you know, that can make me a boring person, but it, I love what makes me a successful scientist.
you're focused on one thing, and that's something that's very valuable, and you're passionate about it, which is what obviously it certainly comes out. Dr. Wyman, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate your insight, and I do look forward to your further research And certainly I'm encouraging all my other viewers to check out his work as well. Again, thanks very much for your time. Bye-bye.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please remember to subscribe to get notifications of upcoming interviews. And you can find me on YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter at Physics High. My name is Paul from Physics High. Till next time.